In a world where good and evil are clearly defined, Hannah Nicole Mayer's debut novel, Assistant to the Villain, blurs these lines with delicious complexity. This TikTok sensation turned bestseller has captivated readers worldwide with its fresh take on the villain trope, becoming BookTok's darling almost overnight. What makes this story so compelling isn't just the slow-burn romance or the witty banter. It's the profound exploration of how we define ourselves when faced with difficult choices. Celebrities like Taylor Swift have reportedly been spotted with the book, and its cultural impact has sparked conversations about moral ambiguity in fantasy literature. With film rights already being discussed in Hollywood circles, this unlikely tale of an administrative assistant to a feared villain has transformed from social media phenomenon to literary sensation. The story begins with Evie wandering into Hickory Forest's dense undergrowth after another demoralizing day of rejected job applications in the village. Following what appears to be a trail of crimson droplets glinting in the afternoon sun, she expects to find an injured deer or rabbit. Instead, she stumbles upon a scene that will forever alter the course of her life. A man in an elaborately embroidered black cloak crouching beside a hollow log. This is her first encounter with the villain himself, though she doesn't immediately realize his identity. The moment shatters every preconception she's harbored about the kingdom's most feared outlaw. The wanted posters plastered across village walls depict a grotesque older man with a twisted face and dead eyes. Yet before her stands a young man whose features possess an almost otherworldly symmetry, high cheekbones, piercing emerald eyes, and an aristocratic bearing that seems at odds with his notorious reputation. In a moment of stunned fascination, she reaches out to touch his face, half convinced he's an illusion. Their initial connection is violently interrupted by the arrival of the king's elite valiant guards, their polished armor glinting through the trees. In the chaos that ensues, an arrow meant for the villain grazes Evie's back, tearing through her worn cotton dress. Rather than abandoning her to save himself, as his ruthless reputation would suggest, the villain demonstrates unexpected compassion. He supports her weight against his side, guiding her toward what he cryptically refers to as safety, his infamous fortress known throughout the kingdom as Massacre Manor. During their flight, he explains he had been protecting a peculiar creature, a magical crowned frog named Kingsley, who possesses powers coveted by unscrupulous village men. Upon reaching his hidden castle, concealed behind layers of ancient protective spells that ripple like heat waves in the air, the villain makes Evie an offer that defies all logic. Impressed by what he calls her cutthroat thinking, demonstrated by her quick-witted responses during their escape, and her willingness to assist him despite his fearsome reputation, he proposes she become his personal assistant. Their negotiation reveals unexpected depths to both characters, Evie's shrewd business sense as she bargains for terms, and the villain's surprising willingness to compromise, including a sworn promise to spare villagers from his truly murderous intents. The agreement is sealed with a handshake that carries its own revelation. His touch is warm and human, not the icy grip of legend. This pivotal meeting establishes the novel's central dynamic, Evie's growing realization that the villain's carefully cultivated reputation might be more complex than she imagined, and his fascination with her practical mind and unflinching nature. Their handshake marks not merely the beginning of an employment arrangement, but the first thread in a complicated tapestry that will challenge both their identities and force them to question everything they believed about the nature of good and evil in their world. 5 months into her employment, Evie has adapted to the bizarre reality of working for the kingdom's most feared man. Her new normal includes finding severed heads hanging from the ceiling. One is acceptable, three indicates her boss is in a mood, and carefully avoiding stray body parts on the floor. Her sense of normalcy has shifted dramatically, reflecting her mother's wisdom that normal was for those unable to stretch their minds. Evie's daily responsibilities range from managing the villain's schedule to supporting his more nefarious activities, torture, murder, and not screaming when finding dead bodies on her desk. Despite these macabre duties, she maintains a cheerful demeanor that both puzzles and intrigues her employer. When she falls from her chair one day, the villain insists she see the healer, despite her protests that no one's ever died from a bruise on the ass. This small interaction reveals his unexpected concern for her well-being, contrasting sharply with his fearsome reputation. The castle staff forms a peculiar workplace ecosystem. Becky, another employee, watches Evie with hawk-like intensity, jealous of her position as the villain's assistant. Edwin, a friendly ogre chef, shares romance novels with Evie during kitchen breaks. There's also Tatiana, the pink accessorized healer, who demands two secrets as payment for her magical treatments. In this strange environment, Evie finds herself oddly at home. The manor provides her with a sense of belonging she never experienced in her village, where she always felt tragically alone. Despite the danger and darkness surrounding her job, she discovers purpose in the structured chaos of the villain's world, a place where her organizational skills and unflappable nature are genuinely valued. The plot thickens when the villain reveals a disturbing development. We have a traitor in our midst. Three shipments have been compromised in 2 months, with King Benedict's valiant guards involved. Unusual since they typically don't interfere with the villain's operations. This revelation transforms Evie's role from mere assistant to investigator, as she eagerly offers to help identify the mole. Evie begins meticulously recording notes about potential traitors in her gold-foiled journal, scrutinizing her fellow workers for any suspicious behavior. Her investigation leads her to Blade Gushikin, the flamboyantly dressed dragon trainer, who provides valuable information about the shipment problems. Despite his perpetual flirting and mismatched clothing, Blade becomes an important ally in her search. The stakes escalate dramatically when Evie discovers a bomb in the villain's office with only 3 minutes left on its timer. In a moment of selfless courage, she races to dispose of it on the parapet, but her heel catches in a loose cement block. As the bomb slips from her fingers and fails to clear the stone rise, Evie finds herself trapped with her boot wedged in the brick, facing imminent death. In this critical moment, the villain appears and throws himself over her, shielding her body with his own and his magic as the world went red. This act of protection marks a turning point in their relationship, revealing the villain's growing attachment to Evie despite his attempts to maintain emotional distance. The bombing incident raises urgent questions. Who planted the explosive? How did they gain access to the villain's private office? And most importantly, what are they planning next? As Evie recovers from her injuries, her determination to identify the traitor only intensifies, driven now not just by professional duty, but by personal loyalty to the man who saved her life. As the story progresses, we begin to see glimpses of the man behind the villain's fearsome facade. His real name is Tristan Arthur Mavereen, though few know this closely guarded secret. When Evie's younger sister Lysa meets him and innocently asks if he's a prince, he flatly denies it, though his courtly manners betray his refined upbringing. Tristan's complexity emerges through small, unexpected moments. His almost laugh disguised as coughing when Evie jokes about her chair turning on her, the single dimple that appears during his rare smiles, and his protective instincts that surface whenever Evie is in danger. Though he maintains a cold, intimidating presence with others, he gradually reveals vulnerability with Evie, allowing her to see beyond his villainous persona. His relationship with his siblings adds further dimension to his character. Malcolm, his estranged brother who runs the Red Bloom Tavern, addresses him with obvious disdain. His sister Claire refuses to forgive him for becoming the villain, while Tatiana, the healer who grew up with the Mavereen siblings, has accepted his transformation. These fractured family relationships hint at the painful past that shaped Tristan's current identity. Perhaps most telling is his relationship with Kingsley, the crowned frog he risked his life to protect when he first met Evie. This small creature serves as both companion and comic relief, holding up signs with messages like help and ouch that humanizes the villain in unexpected ways. His protection of this seemingly insignificant magical creature suggests a capacity for care that contradicts his ruthless reputation. As Evie spends more time with Tristan, she begins to question the kingdom's narrative about him. When she asks what King Benedict could have done to deserve such wrath, Tristan deflects with humor, claiming, "He stepped on my foot once." Yet beneath this flippant response lies a deeper truth about betrayal and injustice that will eventually come to light. The fantasy world Mayer creates is rich with magical elements that drive the plot forward. Titiana's healing magic glows yellow as she mends broken bones and creates potions. Claire's magical ink allows users to reveal words written with ink from the same vial, a seemingly innocent craft that becomes central to the traitor's scheme. Even Tristan's villainous power manifests as a gray mist that reveals his enemy's weak points, allowing him to strike with deadly precision. One of the most fascinating magical elements is the pair of Govras, rare serpentine creatures with bat wings, bulging eyes, and deadly purple venom that melts everything it touches. These creatures are notoriously mated animals with a profound bond. When Tristan captures the male Govra as part of his plan to lure the female, which has been in King Benedict's captivity for 10 years, he explains, "When I say vengeful, I mean it in the most extreme sense of the word. If a female Govra believes her mate is in danger, there are no bars in this world that could hold her." This concept of mated creatures becomes a powerful metaphor throughout the story. The Govra's desperate attempts to reunite despite captivity parallel the growing connection between Evie and Tristan, two people from different worlds drawn inexorably toward each other. Even Tristan, watching the male Govra trying to reach his mate, reflects that it's always better to be trapped together than free and apart when it comes to love. The magical binding between Evie and the dagger that wounded her creates another significant plot point. This connection causes her searing pain whenever the weapon is nearby, a vulnerability that must be overcome through painful exposure therapy with Claire and Titiala's help. This magical wound symbolizes the deeper emotional wounds both Evie and Tristan carry from their pasts, wounds that can only heal through trust and vulnerability. As the mystery of the traitor deepens, Evie's family dynamics come into sharper focus. She lives with her ailing father, Griffin, and younger sister, Lysa, in a humble cottage, carefully hiding her employment at the castle, since anyone associated with the villain faces severe punishment in her village. This double life creates constant tension as she balances her growing loyalty to Tristan with her responsibility to her family. Evie's relationship with her father is strained by memories of her mother's abandonment and her brother's death, tragedies that isolated their family and left Evie feeling responsible for holding everything together. When her father comments that she's so like your mother, Evie responds coldly that, unlike her mother, she's still here. This bitter exchange reveals the abandonment wounds that shape Evie's fierce loyalty once she commits to someone. The plot takes a shocking turn when Evie discovers a crumpled letter in her father's office signed "With Love" from Nura Sage, her mother, whom she believed had abandoned them completely. This discovery coincides with mounting evidence that someone close to Evie has been betraying the villain's operation to King Benedict. In a devastating revelation, Evie learns that her father, Griffin, is actually East Marigold, the traitor who has been using her all along. He never suffered from the mystic illness, but used it as a convenient cover for his covert work as one of King Benedict's valiant guards. Despite having plenty of money from his service to the king, he forced Evie to shoulder the family's financial burden and even planned to marry her off to Otto Warson to have one less child to worry about. When confronted, Griffin admits he began reporting to the king after learning Evie worked for the villain, making her the key to the villain's downfall. In a moment of grim determination, Evie sedates her father with a slow-acting drug hidden in his pain medication, telling him, "We're all monsters in the end. At least mine lives in the light," before he loses consciousness. Throughout the novel, King Benedict is portrayed as a progressive ruler whose valiant guards uphold justice in the kingdom. This public image contrasts sharply with Tristan's decade-long vendetta against him, raising questions about what could inspire such hatred in the villain. The truth emerges when Tristan finally reveals his past. 10 years ago, at 19, his dormant magic caught the attention of King Benedict, who offered him an apprenticeship. Desperate for approval, young Tristan did everything the king asked, including helping capture a govver for its venom. But something disturbed the magical specialist working with him, and servants began avoiding Tristan. When he confronted the king, Benedict claimed Tristan's magic was dangerous and had him imprisoned in complete darkness for a month. "He told me that if he allowed me to go free, I would be a danger to myself and everyone I loved," Tristan explains. The valiant guards regularly beat him in his cell, until one day his magic finally awakened, healing his wounds and illuminating the darkness. "I slaughtered them all," he tells Evie, who responds with fierce approval. "Good." Escaping at sunrise, Tristan vowed that if the king believed me a villain, that was exactly what I would become. His entire identity as the villain was born from this injustice, his criminal activities carefully targeted to undermine Benedict's power rather than harm innocent citizens. Even the men in his dungeon are revealed to be assassins sent by the king rather than random victims of his cruelty. This revelation transforms our understanding of the story's moral landscape. The true villain is King Benedict, who abused his power and betrayed Tristan's trust, while the villain has been fighting a personal war against tyranny all along. Though his methods may be questionable, his cause has more justice than initially appears. The climax begins when Tristan and Evie are ambushed in the forest by King Benedict and his knights. The king reveals his true intentions. He wants his govers back because the female can now produce venom, a powerful weapon he intends to use. When Evie defiantly refuses, Benedict orders Otto Warson to kill her while he takes Tristan away. In a moment of vulnerability that surprises even the king, Tristan falls to his knees, begging for Evie's life. Instead of showing mercy, Benedict injects Tristan with a sedative and orders his knights to take him to the Gleaming Palace, leaving Evie to be killed by Otto. As Tristan is dragged away unconscious, Evie realizes this may be the last time she sees him. Left alone with Otto and two knights, Evie fights back with newfound ferocity. Despite the burning pain, she grabs her dagger and slits Otto's throat as he strangles her, proudly declaring herself his fucking assistant rather than the villain's whore, as Otto had called her. This moment marks Evie's transformation from reluctant participant to active defender of Tristan and everything he stands for. After killing Otto and receiving unexpected help from one of the king's knights, who kills his companion before riding away, Evie returns to the manor with renewed purpose. Despite her grief, she checks on sleeping Lyssa before breaking down in the hallway, crying until only anger remains. Later, bathed and changed, she instructs Marvin to hang Otto's severed head from the ceiling as a display of her new resolve, echoing the villain's own intimidation tactics. When Becky appears, grieving Tristan's capture, Evie promises to rescue him and asks Becky to kill her as part of her plan. As Otto's head dangles from the ceiling, Evie heads to the dungeon, silently vowing to save the villain or become one trying. This powerful closing image shows Evie's complete transformation from an ordinary job seeker to a woman willing to embrace darkness to save the man she loves. At its heart, Assistant to the Villain is a story about finding connection in unlikely places. Evie and Tristan begin as employer and employee, their relationship strictly professional despite the unusual nature of their work. Yet, as they face dangers together, from exploding bombs to vengeful govers, their bond deepens into something neither expected. For Evie, who felt tragically alone in her village, the villain's office becomes a place where she finally belongs. Despite the severed heads and occasional eyeballs on the floor, she finds genuine camaraderie with Blade, Tatiana, and eventually even Becky. When offered the chance to resign with generous severance pay after the bombing incident, Evie refuses vehemently, calling Tristan a selfish bastard for suggesting it. The office has become her home, the one thing that's truly hers, and she won't give it up despite the danger. For Tristan, Evie represents something entirely unexpected, warmth in his cold world. Her presence steadies him, like an anchor to a wayward ship, helping him make better decisions when his power threatens to overwhelm him. When they dance together under the moonlight at Arthur Mavereen's gathering, Tristan shares personal stories about his past, something he's never done with anyone else. This vulnerability marks a significant shift in his character, suggesting that perhaps he doesn't have to remain the villain forever. Their growing connection is captured beautifully in the moment when Tristan realizes he's in love with Evie. He sees her as color in his dark world, every single one, dancing otherworldly and bright over his unworthy eyes. Despite suspecting she might feel the same, he silently vows never to tell her, believing his future leads only to death and refusing to drag her down with him. This tension between connection and self-sacrifice drives the emotional core of the story. Both Evie and Tristan believe they must protect the other, even at the cost of their own happiness. Yet, as the novel concludes with Evie vowing to save the villain or become one trying, we're left with the powerful message that some connections are worth fighting for, even if it means embracing parts of ourselves we never expected. The most thought-provoking aspect of Maher's novel is its nuanced exploration of morality. From the opening pages, the traditional labels of hero and villain are subverted. The villain is handsome rather than grotesque, kind to his employees despite his fearsome reputation, and motivated by a personal vendetta against injustice rather than random cruelty. Meanwhile, King Benedict, ostensibly the kingdom's benevolent ruler, is revealed to be manipulative, vindictive, and willing to imprison and torture an innocent young man. Evie's moral journey forms the emotional backbone of the story. Initially horrified by severed heads and torture chambers, she gradually adapts to the villain's world, finding justifications for actions she once would have condemned. When she sedates her own father after discovering his betrayal, she wonders if this makes her evil, saying, "My father is a monster, and my mother's abandoned me. That's like every villain's origin story, right?" This question, what makes someone a villain, echoes throughout the novel. Is it their actions, their intentions, or how they're perceived by others? When Tristan reveals that he slaughtered the guards who beat him during his imprisonment, Evie's response is simply good, suggesting that vengeance can sometimes be justice. When Tatiana shares that Tristan once told her to never care quite so much of the world's perception of you, we see how he has rejected society's labels to define himself on his own terms. By the novel's conclusion, Evie has embraced aspects of villainy herself, hanging Otto's severed head from the ceiling and heading to the dungeon with plans to save the villain or become one trying. Yet we don't see her as evil. We understand her choices as necessary responses to the injustices she's faced. In this way, Maher challenges readers to look beyond simplistic moral categories and consider the complex circumstances that shape our actions. Perhaps the most powerful message is Evie's declaration to her father, "We're all monsters in the end. At least mine lives in the light." This suggests that acknowledging our capacity for darkness, rather than hiding it behind a facade of righteousness, may be the most honest way to live. In a world where kings can be cruel and villains can be kind, perhaps the true measure of character isn't whether we avoid darkness altogether, but how we navigate it when it inevitably touches our lives.